Hi, you're listening to Generation Squeezes Hard Truths. I'm Megan Wild, and today I'm excited to set the stage for a conversation between our founder, UBC Policy Professor Paul Kershaw, and pollster David Coletto. David's had his finger on the pulse of Canadian public opinion for well over a decade as the founder and head of Abacus Data. So he'll be sharing with you some unique insights into how generational unfairness plays out in our housing, affordability, and climate crises. But first, I want to invite you to Generation Squeeze's next online community call on February 28th. We'll be talking about how fairly governments are investing in all ages, and feature our hot-off-the-press commentary on the BC budget, as well as a forecast of what else you can expect this budget season. Find out more and register on gensqueeze.ca. Now over to Paul and David Coletto.
I am delighted to have you today here on Hard Truths. For years we've known one another, and I view you as the pollster in Canada who is most likely to view Canadian politics through an intergenerational lens. And so I was hoping you could start by sharing what first brought you to see intergenerational tensions in Canadian society and politics.
Well, I think, thanks, and it's great to be here, Paula. Good to see you. What got me interested is that I was unique in terms of owning and running a research company that I was of a younger generation. And
you were the millennial pollster.
I was the millennial pollster. I am still the millennial pollster, although I'm a 42-year-old millennial pollster. And that's crazy to think that millennials are in their 40s now. But I think at the time, and I think still today, I was fascinated by how generation impacts how people think and what they prioritize. But I also recognized, and this was coming at a time where, as a political scientist by training, I understood that young people generally were not engaging in politics as much as older ones, that there was something happening and something wrong that I wanted to better understand. But it was also around the time, you know, Abacus was founded in 2010, of kind of the Obama movement in the United States. And then we saw Trudeau kind of emerge and reignite, I think, some interest among young people. And I wanted to understand it. And so that really was part of it. I was of that ilk, and I didn't think anyone else was really doing it with a Canadian focus either.
No, I think that's really accurate. And then you've built such an amazing business model around it for decades. And I'm a fellow traveler in the intergenerational space, as you know. And one of my experiences is that I sense many a Canadian is more likely to see society and politics when thinking systematically about like systemic racism or classism or sexism or colonialism, heterosexism. It's less common in my experience for citizens to sort of don the glasses of intergenerational fairness and see the world through those glasses. What advice would you give to a group like Gen Squeeze to support more and more people to sort of don those metaphorical glasses of intergenerational issues?
Yeah, first, I think you're right. And I think, you know, kudos to your work and your team's work for trying to push policymakers and anyone in positions of power to look at the decisions they're making and the choices they're making through that lens. Because I don't think it's a instinctual place for people, right? The normal instinct for people usually is, ah, kids these days, you know, they complain. You don't know how hard I had it, and so on. And the good news is, for the most part, and I think there's exceptions to this, when you talk about all the other ways that we put a lens on our analysis, most people don't speak in that way. But they still do when it comes to generational differences. They still, even this morning, bring up the, oh, in 1981, interest rates 21%. And, you know, thank gosh, we have them only at 5% now. And my eyes roll, and my response is, I don't think you understand that the experience and the perceptions of a younger generation today is not the same as it was in 1981 to that younger cohort at that time, which was my parents' generation. And so I think that it's really important. And I look at a lot of things through a political lens. And when I see what goes on in countries that have allowed, and I think most countries have, I don't think Canada's unique in not, you know, thinking clearly about, is there generational equity in the policy choices that we're making? But I think when you look at countries around the world that have democratic systems, and you hear these so-called youthquakes happening, right? Where the divide between how younger residents or citizens vote and those who are older than them, that has political consequences. And so if we don't get this right, if we aren't actively thinking about how do the decisions we're making affect everybody, including, and maybe more importantly, younger people, because they're the ones who have to live with these choices longer term, then there's political consequences to that. And I think we're feeling it right now. I think when I share a poll that says younger Canadians under 30 are as likely or more likely to say Donald Trump's ideas are make sense to me, people said, that doesn't jive with what we think younger people's values are. And I say, well, I don't think they would say Donald Trump's values are aligned with theirs, but they would probably say his anger, his frustration, his defining of the problem,
yeah,
perhaps is increasingly the way I see the world. So anyways, I think it's really important for us to do it. And I don't think it happens nearly enough.
Well, thank goodness that your polling tends to elucidate that for the world of politics. And let's talk more and more about how we can bring it to society and public dialogue more generally. Let me use your reference to housing, though, as a sort of a segue into that space. It's at the epicenter of these intergenerational tensions and opportunities. And you regularly, including last fall, published research showing that housing wealth and housing unaffordability are major intergenerational tensions. Start off for me by summarizing. Your polling is showing that a younger demographic experiences so much grief as a result of the housing system.
Yeah, I mean, the thesis I've put forward is that housing has so clearly become at the center of everything right now in Canada in terms of affecting not just can people afford to live and have a home, but what their future looks like and their choices and their planning. You know, to give you a flavor of what we're found in that survey, you know, and some of this stuff is obvious. Like, people have become more concerned about housing affordability. Younger Canadians overwhelmingly demonstrate some level of concern. They think housing, whether it's ownership or rental, is becoming more expensive, not less. These are all obvious things, right? But then you dig deeper, and this was our objective, is to understand how is this housing crisis actually affecting young people? And 2/3 say they've had to sacrifice spending on food and groceries to pay their housing costs. They've dipped into emergency savings if they have any at all. They've increased their debt payments. They're even delaying starting a family, perhaps moving out of Canada entirely because this doesn't feel like a place that they can afford to live and is giving them the opportunity they have. And that, I think, is true of young Canadians. I think it's true of new Canadians who are coming here, and we see data of signaling that they're regretting the decision and it leading to effects on productivity, because where people choose, it's not where they choose to live, where they have to live, they're postponing or delaying or choosing different career paths because of where they have to live. And we talk about productivity in Canada being at an all-time low and we're not doing enough about it. All this research is signaling to me that unless we solve this problem, it's going to have long-term consequences on, I'm not an economist, but on our economy, on our social fabric, and then on our political outcomes, because they're all related.
They are. And it also will have then longer-term implications for the financial well-being and the more general well-being of younger folks later in their retirement years. You know, you said two interesting things today. On the one hand, we can still run into some stupid myths that younger folks, if only they had fewer lattes or less avocado toast, then they too could pay their rent. And that kind of dumb cultural trope still pops up occasionally. But my sense of it is more and more, including in the world of politics, the description you just gave to show how hard work isn't paying off for young folks today by comparison with past generations is increasingly an accepted view. And they understand that the gap between rent and homeownership costs and what earnings pay, even for people making good livings. I feel like your work, groups like Gen Squeeze, have kind of moved society to acknowledge that more often than not. What I think we've been less successful at Gen Squeeze in doing is saying, a younger demographic and newcomers of any age, to your point, have been harmed by our housing system. the things that are harming some have actually benefited others. And I really like to use my own personal story to showcase that, that, you know, I definitely had to work hard to get into home ownership in 2004, now 20 years ago. But in the 20 years since, my home has increased by in value by $1.5 million just while I've been sleeping and watching TV. And it has actually really given me a tremendous wealth windfall. And Gen Squeeze has been talking about that for years, but whereas we've had people recognize the harm to some, we've been much less effective at having people recognize the benefits to others. And I wonder, since you're someone who, like, you tap into people's heads and hearts on a weekly basis, what advice might you give us to steward and curate that conversation effectively?
That's a great question. I think the first point is, I think when you actually scratch away even just a bit of the surface, most people who own a home and have owned a home, let's say, for a decade or more, understand first how fortunate they are and how wealthy that asset has made them. Now, to your point, Paul, you've got to kind of highlight that. But what I start with is also, despite that privilege, there's still deep anxiety, right? So it requires us to understand, why is it that people become very defensive? Mm-hmm. And it's in part because, as a society, most people who even have that home and are probably have generated more wealth than they absolutely need to sustain a life and a retirement and all that, see that asset as kind of fundamental to all of those things. And so from a public policy and particularly a political angle, I think there's always resistance to making choices that will be perceived to be raiding, I use that term, not in a way that I believe, but raiding that asset because of how defensive people have become of it. So how do you communicate that? I think it's shifting though, Paul. Like, I do think, I love my client, the Canadian Real Estate Association. We know what their objectives are, but they have at least been asking these questions for a long time. When we did surveys 5-6 years ago, the gap between those who said housing is a crisis was very generational. It was like, if you were under 40, you said, yes, absolutely. And everybody else was like, yeah, it's okay. At least I think in the intermediate years, because the problem has become so acute and so universal.
Yeah.
It's not isolated to where you live and where I was raised in around Toronto. It's now Cape Breton to, you know, rural Saskatchewan. Housing affordability is an issue. I think what's happened is people who still own that are much more open to things like, maybe we should tax capital gains on your primary residence. Maybe a wealth tax is something that we should explore, particularly for those who have wealth of a certain amount. And I think that shift has happened because people are understanding that the housing crisis that is affecting so many, but has enriched so many others, can't go on without literally destroying the society they see. And so when people are going out into any community and seeing the number of people without a home rising, that's a signal that something's not working right. And so I think we're getting closer, Paul, I really do. And I think so the environment's there for you to actually communicate the benefits that people have had because they've had that opportunity, and for us to articulate what happens if we don't at least reduce the gap. Because your point is so true. I tell everybody, the largest predictor of inequality among those, you know, 30 to 40 is whether they own their home or not. And that is going, over 30, 40 years, is going to make this country far more vulnerable mm-hmm. to the kinds of shocks that none of us want to see. And housing will be the thing that creates that rise of extremism that is right now starting to occur.
Well, aside from your last couple of observations, we have a very hopeful note to that. And I want to engage more with that hopefulness, bringing you to another theme that our team has really been struck by in your work. We see you talking a lot about Canada being at a crossroads because the proportion of Canadians who fall subject to zero-sum thinking is on the rise. The idea that one group gain comes at the expense of another. And you've been suggesting that zero-sum thinking has significant consequences for Canada. I'd love to explore what you think those consequences are. And then I think you think there's like a positive sum conversation to have. And I want to help talk about that a bit well. And I think housing can be the epicenter of that. But first, tell us about some of your concerns or your observations about the impact of zero-sum thinking and it being on the rise in Canada.
Yeah, let me just take a step back and say, how do we get an increase? And there's an interesting study that I cited that comes out of Harvard that shows the kind of times you were socialized and grew up in does affect your mindset. And what I've seen emerge just generally in Canada, and I think it's true in most countries right now, is what I call a scarcity mindset. And that means people are looking around at a range of things, housing, healthcare, food, you name it, and saying the things that I need in my life that I've maybe in the past took for granted seem far more scarce, harder to get, harder to keep, more expensive to acquire. And the result is the rise in zero-sum thinking, right? Because if the world's a tough place, if survival is what's driving me, if materialism, not in the sense that we often think materialism is like, oh, I want lots of stuff. It's, can I even just get the stuff I need to live? And I'm worried I may not get that. And zero-sum thinking basically says, if I'm losing, that's because somebody's winning. And that creates the environment for us versus them. It creates the environment where, as we see right now, not just the public opinion has shifted, but the commentary and the discussion about immigration, for example, has gone to a point where we're pointing at immigration as the problem, when in reality, the problem is we have really poor planning going on in our major government institutions, who you and I, Paul, could have told them 20 years ago that you've got a demographic problem
40 years ago
on our way in Canada. It's simple, right? Like, it's like, we know we're an aging country. We had this baby boom and they're getting old and they're going to live longer and we need to replace that population. So that is what's creating the zero-sum thinking. Now, positive-sum thinking occurs when people have a shared collective sense that things are going to get better. And I think one of the things that, even though I often make presentations that sound gloomy and doom is on the way, is somebody, I try to be kind of optimistic about it. And I say, if there's any country in the world that can figure this out, that has enough wealth, that's enough opportunity, that knows how to bring different people together and live together, it's Canada. And so positive sum thinking is basically saying, like, we can lift all boats. Everybody can have a home, maybe not be able to own, but everybody should be able to have shelter and kind of live the life that they want. And let's figure out the public policy choices that get us there is what I focus on a lot.
I love that observation that things can get better. And I think there's so much at play with this sense of, are we in a moment of scarcity or are we a moment of affluence? And I think that the housing system is such a place to explore that theme. Because when I think about your dialogue around zero-sum thinking, right now, I think descriptively, our housing system has done that between generations. A younger demographic is just really struggling to pay for shelter, afford suitable shelter. As a result of my generation, especially those who came before me, sort of extracting so much wealth from our housing system and not really being mindful of what that was doing for those who follow in our footsteps. So I think there is that, hey, that group has gained at my expense. But it doesn't need to be that way. I mean, the housing system really has been a place of generating affluence, generating wealth. We are producing more housing wealth in this country than any other G7 country out there. We just don't think about asking people like me who've been gaining windfalls to be contributing a portion of it to our community, to those who follow in our footsteps. And so I wonder, again, you're the brilliant post-pollster, routinely tapping into people's hearts and heads on a weekly basis. What opportunities do you see when thinking about having people see that our housing system isn't a place of scarcity? It's actually been a place of producing wealth in a way that can be beneficial for the owner of the asset, but also beneficial for the country.
Yeah, and I think my advice is to start reframing it. And I think you deserve credit. You are trying to, and you're pushing against a consensus that doesn't want to because their economic interests are not to do that, right? You're asking people to sacrifice, and not sacrifice very much, by the way.
No.
I say sacrifice, not in the sense that it is a true sacrifice, but in their minds, it's like, you own a $3 million home in the suburbs of Toronto that maybe 5 years ago was worth two, and 5 years earlier was worth one. You've tripled your wealth for being lucky enough to have bought that home and being able to afford that home. Like, it's basically a lottery in a lot of ways. And so I think it's tapping into it, but not judging people for their success.
Not being righteous. Yeah, okay. Not judging.
Not being righteous about it, but tapping into what I think still exists in most people, which is a sense that if we're going to want to build a community that I want to continue to live in, that I think is safe, that is fair, then I probably do need to give up some. And I think we have there's elements in our tax system that do that. There's other things we probably could do. So I think with the right leadership, with the right narrative, you could bring enough of the public along that it's possible. Again, because people are not stupid. They see what's going on around the world and they understand why it's happening. And every day they're, you know, when I ask Canadians, what's keeping you up at night? Right now, it is issues around affordability and housing and that sense of scarcity. You're right. You just need to slightly change their frame of mind. And then they'll realize, actually, there's not that much scarcity in my life. I have a lot that I didn't think I did.
Well, there's a narrative project for us to collaborate on. Like, what are the subtle shifts to sort of nudge people to view it slightly differently that can really help Canada achieve its maximum potential? Maybe one place that nudging and reframing can take place is via our ask at the federal level. We've been working really hard at the federal level to say, federal government, let's launch a task force on intergenerational fairness. Why is hard work not paying off for younger folks like it used to? And, you know, we've been meeting pretty regularly with senior folks. We have decent access to the Prime Minister's office and to various other ministries. And yet, as we've been making this ask, you know, there's been a commission for injury in sports and harassment in sports. There's been a kind of task force on car theft, but there's been no generational fairness task force quite yet. And so since you are such a political thinker and leader, got any advice for us as we're trying to launch a generational fairness task force? Any thoughts about what would be the compelling case for them, knowing that they're not that far from an election and your polling shows they have lost younger folks to other parties?
Yeah, I mean, you just articulated why they should do it. I think this is a government that won their majority and then the last two elections because young people voted for the Liberals. I think there's pretty clear evidence that without Canadians under the age of 40, Justin Trudeau wouldn't be prime minister today. So it doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, he appointed himself minister of youth after he won in 2015, the first minister of youth we have. That's kind of disappeared. Again, I don't know Mr. Trudeau. I don't know everybody who's really close to his government. But I do think that part of the fear of a government that's 8 years in office is if you were to do that commission, if you were to bring it together, it would remind people just how little they've actually done, which is part of the problem the government at this stage faces. So when you're thinking about the purpose of this inquiry or this kind of work that would be done, it would be less about help giving their opponents more ammunition to say you failed to deliver on the promise you made. And instead, let's roll up our sleeves and realize, this is my frank assessment, this government has a very hard time admitting it hasn't delivered or it hasn't done everything it could. And so if you're not willing to do that, then it's very hard for you to do what you're asking them to do, Paul. But I do think they have to. They have to do something. And it doesn't need to be like policy ideas that just don't really move the needle on the problems. But they have to demonstrate empathy and understanding that there is a real problem that younger Canadians are facing, and most don't believe they are listening or they understand it. And I'll just give you one example. A number of months ago, the Prime Minister did an interview with Jamie Poisson on the CBC Daily podcast, Front Burner. And it was all about housing. And this was around the time when the Liberals' kind of vote was collapsing, and our surveys and others were showing that young people were really leaving the Liberals. And just to keep in mind, I just want to put a point on this. The Liberal Party is less popular among those aged 18 to 30 than they are among those 60 and over. That is a complete shift in where this party was politically for the last 8 years. So just to note that. And in this interview, Jamie Poisson asks him, what do you say to young people who say they can't find a house to live in? They can't afford it. And the Prime Minister, and I'm not quite paraphrasing it because I think he used this term, he's like, my heart breaks for them. And I was like, that is the wrong term. Like, oh, my heart breaks. I'm so, like, that's what, like, the King of England says about his subjects, not what someone who's actively in the most powerful position in the country who could do something about it reacts to. So my advice is to keep pushing them, But it feels like they don't actually know how to do it, or they don't want to because they know it's going to uncover a bunch of things where they have actually not done enough. And now we're in this problem.
So much to unpack there. I'm going to try and I want to go in two directions. The second one, I'm not going to start here, but I just alert you to, I want to acknowledge, I think that Mr. Polyev is doing a strong job at tapping into the grief that a younger demographic is feeling about, you know, to use his language, the housing hell. Mm-hmm. So I want to explore that. But before doing so, I actually think that one of the reasons why the federal Liberals should launch a task force on generational fairness is that they could use that to partly acknowledge, you know, we've been inheriting some decisions, not from Mr. Harper, but from decades ago, that actually were poor planning by government. So if you said, Paul, 20 years ago, I said 40 years ago, we could have alerted people that we were going to have some problems. A half century ago, we decided to shelter housing wealth windfalls in our principal residences from taxation. It's not surprising that that's going to then shape how Canadians think about accumulating wealth and how they're going to want their homes to go up in value. And you kind of socialize us to think that way. Decades ago, governments got out of like investing more in not-for-profit housing. These aren't things actually that are Mr. Trudeau's fault. He's just now the person holding the bag. And you could say that more generally around taxation and then like the really growing spending that's happening for our seniors, for our retirees, my mom, for old age security and medical care. But we knew that was going to happen when boomers started out. There were 7 working age residents for every retiree. Now that boomers are retirees, there's just 3 working age people coming in their footsteps. Mathematically, we knew that was going to happen. And so I think that there's an opportunity for federal government right now that has been losing a younger demographic to say, oh, we get your pain. And we are now the government that's going to start tackling these intergenerationals that previous governments have been neglecting literally for decades.
I agree. I think that's the starting point, is to demonstrate to people that, again, some will criticize, okay, more meetings, more conversations, more committees, but it's the acknowledgement of the problem, right? Mm-hmm. As we do and continue to do with Indigenous people, where we acknowledge what decisions we've made in the past that have harmed people, that have hurt people, and we're trying to reconcile that. I'm not saying we need a reconciliation with younger people, but we do need an acknowledgement. Because I think one of the things I see in public opinion among young people is just a lack of hope. They don't believe there's anyone actually actively working to solve the problems that they believe they're going to face, right? I think on climate, this government, as an example, has probably, at least rhetorically and on ambition, been more aggressive to say we have a responsibility to ensure that this planet, and yes, we're a small part of the world, but we're going to do our part. They could take the same framing and apply it to other parts of the economy and of society, whether that be housing or education. And so there is a model for them to follow. And I think that's why an organization like yours is so important, to keep pushing them and showing them that path forward.
Okay. I want to use your lack of hope observation to pivot a little bit to Mr. Polyev. So I'm struck by Mr. Polyev. He's doing a strong job at acknowledging the sort of emotional impact of housing. I think in some regards, though, I observe him to kind of be farming rage. And I wonder, he seems really strong on the problem, less strong potentially on like, here are the policy solutions to give you hope. You know, is my characterization there consistent with what you're seeing in the polling data?
To some extent. Again, I look at it and I say, well, how frequent are opposition parties putting in the window detailed policy prescriptions?
Fair enough.
I agree that that's a criticism that's fair of them, but I don't expect them to do it quite yet. There's definitely an effectiveness in what he is saying and what the party is saying that is connecting them with a demographic who previously wouldn't even consider it, right? So that is step one. They are very, very effective at farming the rage? Is it harvesting the rage? There's two different frames there, right? Like,
yeah.
Like if that rage already exists and you're just harvesting it versus if you cultivated it and you're helping it grow, I think a little bit of both. But I do think that at some point, and this is where when we ask people, what do you think a conservative government led by Mr. Polyev would do? And should they do it? And there is a growing understanding and belief that on an issue like housing, because they talk about it so much, that they will make housing more affordable. Now, if I ask a follow-up and say, well, give me the ideas they have, they don't have any, and people don't know what they would do, but there's a belief there, right? And politics is not about public policy fundamentally. It's about communication and engagement. And so I don't think they actually have to, Paul. And I think they can win an election and energize that younger cohort to believe that they're going to do something simply because the Liberals haven't delivered in those people's same minds. Even if you now have a federal government, I think that is overdrive on housing and trying to do everything all at once. But on an issue, let's take climate change, for example. When you ask Canadians, do you think that Pierre Poilievre and the Conservatives will take climate change seriously as a government? Most people either say no or they're unsure. But when you ask them, do you think they should? Almost everybody says yes. Even 70% of those who are open to voting Conservative. And so that to me is where the opportunity and the threat for the Conservatives lie, not just climate, but on these broader issues, is that as we get closer and closer to election, more and more people are going to be asking the question that you're asking now is, show me your plan. How are you actually going to do it? And that's where I think, you know, the intent that they have and the motivation they've built up may get stalled and may not be converted into actual votes because they haven't articulated exactly how that's going to happen.
Well, let's then wind down on the Conservative Party and climate. I suggested earlier, I think that Mr. Poilievre has been quite strong from an intergenerational perspective on housing. When it comes to his Axe the Tax campaign there, I think he has intergenerational blind spots because, you know, the success of his campaign has been to undermine like the moral responsibility we have to pay for our pollution. And so I'm curious, is where might you see opportunities in the polling for us to shift the narrative from people saying, oh, it's all the price on pollution is causing all this unaffordability, to say, no, how do we relieve your wallet pressures from better housing policy, childcare policy, retirement policy, so that we can address that moral obligation that we have? Like, if we make a mess, we better help pay to clean it up.
Yeah, I think the first point is we'll have some data out in the next few days. Already be out when you listen to this podcast, but we will have data that will show on the idea of a carbon price, pollution price, carbon tax, however you want to frame it. Almost half of Canadians under 30 think it's a good policy. Only a third of those over 60 think that. So what you just described shows up in the data, right? That younger Canadians recognize this sounds like it's good policy, that we should be paying for the stuff that's going to do harm now and disencourage that kind of behavior, right? So it is about speaking to that older generation and who, by the way, are just as likely to say, at least in surveys, that they care deeply about climate change and they think it's a problem. But then on the flip side say, but I've been convinced that this policy choice does not move the needle or is too expensive for us to do and there's other ways of doing it. Mm-hmm. I think the Conservatives have been very effective at linking the short-term pain people are experiencing, that scarcity mindset I talked about, and saying, look, climate change we know will create scarcity down the road, even though it is creating scarcity now, but it's a longer-term problem. Let's deal with the short one now. I think there's a real opportunity. And if the Conservatives, to tie it back to what we talked about just a few minutes ago, are going to want to convert this opportunity they have with young people into actual votes, they are deeply liable on that question, right? And I don't believe for a minute, for a second, that Pierre Poilievre and the Conservatives are going to change their position on the carbon tax. They have become defined. That is the thing Canadians know they will do. More Canadians believe they will do that than anything else. They've defined themselves on that. But the problem for them is that, I think it's a problem. They would say it's a good thing. At the same time that people want them to cut the axe, the tax, they also want them to take climate seriously. And people, and this is a communications problem the government's, I think, created, don't associate the two together. So I think you have to keep talking about the decisions and actions we take today as being down payments, to go back to tie it all back together to housing, on the future and the kind of world that we're leaving for future generations and those that are here now. And that shows up clearly in the public data that I've seen and is the challenge that you have, because it's climate change is dropping as a top issue and everything is just overwhelmingly saturated and focused on those day-to-day cost of living issues.
Well, we've come to the end of our time, David, and my head is buzzing. My heart is actually pounding, both with enthusiasm and a little bit of anxiety. Your observation about how climate is kind of moving down in terms of popular focus, affordability is a top, that actually gives me hope for Gen Squeeze. Like, it's not an either-or thing. It's a both-and. we can reduce the pressure on our wallets while also being good ants as a good citizens, you know, for our kids and grandchildren and those who will come thereafter. And so I take your observations as like a personal call to action. Like, I hope that you and our listeners will see us double down and get better on that over the months ahead. And what a treat to have you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Paul. Take care.
Thanks so much for listening to Generation Squeeze's Hard Truths. Please check out the show notes for links to the Abacus research that Paul and David discussed, as well as a link to David's In Focus newsletter on Substack.